Thank you, Shira, and thank you everybody who's here. It's wonderful to see you. Even though what we're going to study today is not exactly wonderful in content, the being with you is wonderful. And I should say, before we start actually delving into the material we read today, is what I want to say is that we've reached a crucial turning point in the book of Judges, because the judge we discussed last time, Shimshon, was the last real judge. With him, the part of judges that can be rightly be called judges is kind of over. And instead, what we see is a set of stories. Today, we're only going to visit one of them, even though it's a complex and big one, that don't follow the pattern, the cycle that was outlined in the very beginning of the book, the cycle of the people abandoning God, God abandoning them to the not-so-tender mercies of the people around them, them suffering under subjugation and attacks and harassment by other people, calling out to God, and God relenting and sending a judge to save them, only for them to revert back to their abandonment of God once the judge is dead. So that cycle that became almost banal, almost cliche at some point through the book because it's so expected and familiar and run-of-the-mill, suddenly and abruptly just disappears. And all of a sudden we'll see stories that follow a very different pattern. And interestingly, the form here reflects the content, because even as we see the storytelling pattern break, fall apart, rearrange itself, the content that we see in these stories is Israelite society falling apart. If until now the focus of the book was the geopolitical suffering of the people, even though it gave us plenty of insight into the kind of horrors that exist between people and the way people can mistreat each other, the focus nevertheless was on wars and suffering caused by enemies from the outside. In these stories, what we will see is the kind of suffering and injustice and pain that's inflicted within the nation, between groups, between people, within families. And in a very, forgive me. The text here uses a powerful form to show us just how bad things are, just how deeply flawed society is, by starting each of these stories of collapse, one which we will follow today, one which we will follow next time, with a moment when it looks like people within a family are about to set things right. There's something wrong in the family that happens off stage and is referred to in the beginning, and we will see in a minute what happens in our story. And the story starts when people are expressing their goodwill and their desire to restore and heal the relationship within the family. But in both cases, the one we'll follow today and the one, the more horrific and bloody one we will follow next week, the attempt to heal, the attempt to fix things ends up in betrayal and collapse that exceeds the bounds of the family and affects first the tribe and eventually the nation as a whole. So without further ado, let us delve right in into this week's family. In this case, intimate duo of son and mother. This is not something we've seen so far in the book. We saw fathers and daughters, both in the case of Kalev and Achsa, way in the beginning, and later in an almost dark reflection, but a mirror image of it, with Iftach and his daughter, because Kalev gave his daughter life and land and water, while Iftach gave his daughter death. We saw parents, a duo of parents and their son, their unruly son who doesn't listen to them in the case of Shimshon. But we haven't really seen yet the intimate relationship between a man and his mother until now. So let us start without further ado. I'm in Judges 17, verse 1, in the first box of the source sheet. There was a man in the hill country of Ephraim whose name was it's an inaccurate description here, an inaccurate translation, Michayahu. Now, I want to pause here and point out, and here I'm following the scholarship of Professor Eli Assis, from whom I learned that, that the word Michayahu is a powerful word of faith, because what it means is me ke Hashem, who is like Yahu, like Hashem. And it's an expression or even an exclamation, I would say, of faith, of awe and joy in the face of God's glory. It's saying, who like God? The implication, of course, being that no one is like God, that God is the only one who's like God, and that we are therefore going to worship him forever. This usage of a name will turn out to be very ironic, but let us continue for now. We met this man named Mika. Note also that we don't know his father's name, which is a symptom of a society that loses its sense of history, its sense of family lineage. But he does have a mother. He said to his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you so that you uttered an imprecation, which you repeated in my hearing, I have that silver. I took it. In other words, what we get through his direct speech is a confession of guilt. I stole your money. Interestingly, he doesn't say the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, I took it. No. He puts the spotlight on the curse, on the imprecation that his mother made against whoever stole her silver. And we'll come back to it in a minute. What follows directly here, before we start unpacking the implication, it's important to note it, is a moment of forgiveness. The mother doesn't say, how dare you? The mother doesn't say, I stand behind my imprecation. She said, blessed of the Lord be my son, said his mother, clearly counteracting or counterweighing the imprecation she made, presumably using God's name or some allusion to God, against the anonymous thief of her money. In order to balance it out, she's now saying, blessed to the Lord be my son. On the face of it, here is a beautiful moment of people correcting their mistakes. He is correcting his theft. He is returning the money. And she, in a moment of motherly love and care, is not avenging herself, is not standing up for justice, but rather standing up for love. Contrasted, for example, with Iftach's behavior in a moment when his speech, his imprecation, created a news that captured his daughter by mistake. Much like this woman made an imprecation that captured under it her son by mistake. Iftach didn't do anything. He just accepted it as a given that he can't change anything about it. The mother here doesn't accept it. And it looks like maybe what we see here is a little bit of an opening of the world of redemption. Because redemption in Hebrew is not just the redemption as we imagine, the end of days when God brings judgment and joy and wolves and sheep sit in the same, together. I have to tell you, my parents' street in Jerusalem has runaway bunnies in it and street cats. And they all sit together. Every time I go there, I feel like the prophet Yeshayahu should come and visit. Either way, that's just an aside. When we say Geulah, redemption in Hebrew, we mean restoration. And it looks like there's an opening for restoration, a restoration in the individual case of Micha and his mother, and an restoration perhaps in the way people behave themselves in Israel in general. If until now we saw people like Iftach making imprecation and then not making the effort to free their children from it, maybe here we're seeing the beginning of something else. Except that already at this moment, despite its excitement, despite its promise, there's question marks. There's all kinds of little things that challenge our assumption that what we see here is honest restoration, or perhaps invite us to think, to put it a little differently, that the foundations upon which this restoration, this ge'ulah, is built are faulty. And the first amongst them is already in the verses we read. It's in the fact that Michayahu, as I pointed out before, makes a point of the imprecation when he talks to his mother about the money, right here where I'm highlighting on the page, which raises the question, would he have confessed if she didn't make the imprecation in his hearing, which she repeated in my hearing, as he says? If she would have made the imprecation elsewhere and he hadn't known about that, if he wasn't afraid that his mother's curse is going to somehow get to him, would he have returned the money? Would he have confessed? Is it really a son regretting a wrong he did to his mother, or is it a man worried for his own skin? Let's take it a step deeper. Why did she repeat the imprecation in his hearing? It's noteworthy that it's not that she made the imprecation and I happened to hear it. No. He says two things. He says, you, Alit, you made an imprecation. Vegam amart beoznai. And also you repeated my hearing. Perchance, she suspected it's him and she said it on purpose next to him to inspire him to do something about it. So suddenly, from a situation of someone showing just total regret and remorse and, you know, recanting his actions, we start wondering what exactly is motivating him and how aware was she throughout? Now, these are little cracks. One could say that even if he's motivated by self-interest, he's still doing the right thing and returning the money. And she is still doing the right thing and blessing him instead of cursing him at this point. But then let's keep reading and see the other cracks that start adding to this picture. He returned 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, but his mother said, I herewith consecrate the silver to the Lord. Now, this looks great. We've seen so many instances of the people violating the covenant with God, idol worshiping. And here's this woman dedicating an amount of money that at this time was very much money. It wasn't a small amount of money at all. 1,100 coins of silver is the same amount of money that the Philistines, each of the Philistines' leader, paid Delilah to surrender Samson's secret to them. It's a big sum. It's a significant sum. And here we see a woman who, no matter how well-to-do she is, this is a big chunk of her wealth, is dedicating it to God. It seems as if it's not only a step towards Geulah on the personal interconnectedness of a family level, it's a step towards Geulah in the relationship of the people with God. Except listen how she goes about it. What does it mean to her that she consecrated it to the Lord? Transferring it to my son to make a sculptured image and a molten image. I now return it to you. She's giving her son the money and she tells him, I'm consecrating it to God and you should use it by making exactly that which God told us in Sinai not to do. It's a second commandment. It's not exactly a obscure part of Torah. We all know we're not supposed to create idols. And yet what she tells him is create an idol, in a sense, a mask, an image, to serve God. The way she goes about the restoration of the relationship between people and God is wrong in the core of it. It's faulty. It's a nice idea built on mistaken foundation, on a mistaken understanding of what God wants from us. And then the plot thickens because it says, so when he gave the silver back to his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave it to a smith. He made of it a sculptured image and a molten image, which were kept in the house of Micha. Again, it's Michayahu. It's not Micha. Wait a minute. The first sum was 1,100 silver shekels. Now we hear that they used 200 silver shekels. What happened to the other 900 silver shekels? If the whole sum was consecrated to God, no matter the fact that she used it to serve God in an erroneous, rotten way, a way that's rotten at the core of it, she didn't use the whole money. She said she consecrated the whole sum of money, but not the whole sum of money went into it. Now, the commentators argue about this. Some say that the rest of the money was used for bringing sacrifices, offerings, creating a site of worship around these masks and image that she made. Others say that she got a good deal on the silversmith to make the idol that she wanted to make, and the rest she kept for herself because she said, why do I need to buy idol for so much money when I can buy it for less? In other words, she's defrauding God. Either way, let's continue in verse 5. Now the man Michah had a house of God. A house of God. That's quite the declaration. He had made an ephod, which was some sort of a ritual object, and teraphim, which was the word that we know already from the story of Rachel stealing her father's idols, teraphim. And he had inducted one of his sons to be his priest. Now, you don't become a priest because somebody inducts you to be a priest. And in Judaism, you're a priest if you're born a priest, if you're born a Kohen. So everything around this Beit Elokim, this house of God, is in violation of the way God himself told us to make a home for him. And yet, this cognitive dissonance doesn't seem to be even conscious to the people acting here. And a hint as to why that is comes in the next verse, a famous verse, because it repeats itself throughout the last part of Shoftim, the part that we're starting today. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did as he pleased. Now, it should be said that this phrase alludes to a particular verse in Dvarim that means something specific. In Dvarim, Moshe tells the people, I'm going down a little bit in the source sheet, just a minute, to box 7 in page 4. Moshe warns us in the book of Dvarim that when we get to Israel, he tells the people who are still in the desert, of course, when you get to Israel, you should build one place. God will choose a place to dwell in, and that's where we should bring our offerings. And he says in verse 8, you shall not act at all as we now act here, every man as he pleases. What he says is, Ish kol ha'yashar b'enav, every man as his right, as a straight in his own eyes. And what he means, specifically in this context, is we shall not bring our sacrifices to God wherever we want. Right now in the desert, you kill your animals and eat them, not always in the Mishkan. But that's not what you're going to do. Once you're in Israel, there's going to be one place to bring offering to God. And you should not build centers of worship that are separate from that place, from that new geographic center of consecration in the nation's life. And the opposite of this is Ish kol ha'yashar b'enav, everybody going to wherever is straight, is right in their own eye, and bringing their offering there. So when it says, I'm going back to box 1, in those days there was no king in Israel, every man did as he pleased, really, Ish ha'yashar b'enav yaseh, it implies, one, that people bring sacrifices wherever they want, as we just saw in the case of Michael. But it probably implies something beyond that. It probably implies that there is no one clear idea of what is just and right to do. There's no sense of this is the way we do things. People are figuring it out. People try their best. People have good intentions in many cases. We see here that Micha has good intentions. His mother has good intentions. But they pursue these good intentions without the benefit of some bigger structure of guidance. They just do what occurs to them to be the right thing. In many ways, it's the fact that they do it and clearly don't think that it's a deviation from God's law. The fact that they do it fully believing that they are consecrating the money for God and building a home for God, Beit Elokim, probably teaches us more than anything else, if we allow ourselves to look at it as an archaeological find, so to speak, trying to understand the era, that there was very widespread ignorance in the era. If you recall, when we learned about Yiftach, we said something similar. We said that the fact that Yiftach thought that a vow that requires him to sacrifice a human being is valid, the fact he thought it's even valid, more than anything else, shows that he just didn't know the law, which means that there is no widespread awareness of God's law at the time. And within that vacuum, and within the vacuum of leadership also implied by the word king, which we will come to in a bit, people of good intentions trying to restore both their own relationships with each other and their relationship with God go about it in ways that we, looking as readers thousands of years later, can see are somehow not really hale and sound, don't really hold water. The foundation is problematic. As we will see, and we will get to it shortly, what happens when the foundation of a home isn't sound? Under pressure, this home will collapse. And indeed, both the family that Michal is trying to establish and the home of God, quote unquote, that he creates, seeing as they're built on shaky foundations, on wrong ideas, will not withstand pressure.
Rachel, sorry. Yes. Where are the Leviim and the Kohanim? Are the people who are supposed to be teaching? Where are they from there, from beginning?
So I'm glad you asked that, because we're about to meet one of them. We're about to meet a Levite, and we will see that not only is he not fulfilling his role of teaching, but he is benefiting from this reality of people not knowing what's the right thing to do. And he himself doesn't seem to know what the right thing is to do. In other words, if there was supposed to be an elite, an educated elite that gives the people guidance, which there was, I mean, this was one of the roles of the priests, clearly defined from already the Torah itself, from the books of Moses, they're not rising to that occasion. They're not rising to the challenge. Let us meet that young man and see for ourselves. He's going to become a very intriguing and interesting character in the story. I'm in box number 2. There was a young man, Anal in Hebrew, from Bethlehem of Yehuda, from the clan seat of Yehuda. He was a Levite and had resided there as a sojourner. In Hebrew, it just said, which has the implication of sojourning. That in itself makes sense, that the Levite or a priest would not have, would be under the patronage of other people. That in itself makes sense. However, the Levites were supposed to have their own cities in the land of Israel, the cities that Moshe himself already started dedicating, saying this city will be a Levite city, this city will be a Levite city. So the fact that he is not in a Levite city, he's sojourning somewhere else, is telling. Not only that, he leaves. He doesn't stay there. He's not like a Chabad Shaliach who goes to a place and then stays there and takes responsibility for it. He moves on. In verse 8, this man had left the town of Bethlehem of Yehuda to take up residence wherever he could find a place. Rabbi Nitya L. Ziegler here in Jerusalem points out in her book about Ruth, about another family that leaves Bethlehem and goes somewhere. The family of Elimelech, whose wife Naomi ends up being mentor to Ruth and Moabiah, that this story right here and this description of a man who just leaves and goes and doesn't have a destination and is just trying to find a place to live, it gives us a little bit of an insight into the era, showing us that it was a time of displacement. People didn't have a place. They weren't rooted in the land in the way that we imagine them to be, or in the way they should have been. There's no strong social ties to hold someone in place. People go, as we will see soon, tribes go from place to place, not just people. There's a certain feeling of loose ends. And the goal, the overarching goal of people like this Levite is survival. He needs to find a place to sustain himself. In other words, the people in Bethlehem are not supplying him with that. The people he used to live amongst are not giving him living, the ability to live amongst them financially and in terms of sustenance, which is a problem throughout the book of Shoftim, people not offering each other sustenance, but we will leave that for now because we will get to that big time next week. For now, we see this young man meandering around. And on his way, I'm in the middle of verse 8, he came to the house of Micha in the hill country of Ephraim. Where do you come from? Micha asked him. Now note, by the way, that now it's correct. Now he really is called Micha in Hebrew, as if now that he built a house of God that's all idolatry and misses the mark of what God actually wants from us, he can no longer have the name of God inside his full name. Where do you come from? Micha asked him. He replied, I am a Levite from Bethlehem of Judah, and I am traveling to take up residence wherever I can find a place. Stay with me, Micha said to him, and be a father and a priest to me. And I will pay you 10 shekels of silver a year, an allowance of clothing, and your food. The Levite went. The Levite agreed to stay with the man, and the youth became like one of his own sons. Note that there's something interesting going on with family relationships here. After all, this is a course about family relationships, so it behooves us to pay attention to this. Not only did the story start with a man and his mother, now he meets the stranger and he invites him to be his father. Obviously in some spiritual sense, but still he uses the word of. But then what actually happens is that the stranger becomes for Michal like a son. Either way, whether he's a father or a son, it's clear that what Micha offers this man is not just a financial arrangement where he pays him and clothes him and feeds him and gives him shoes, but rather an emotional arrangement, a place in his heart, a place in his family dynamics. This will only make what happens later all the more poignant and tragic, and the betrayal of this boy, spoiler alert, all the more devastating, but we have to get there yet. So let's continue. I'm in verse 12. Micha inducted the Levite, and the young man became his priest and remained in Micha's shrine. Now I know, Micha told himself, that the Lord will prosper me since the Levite has become my priest. Everything about these two verses is wrong. Is just a topsy-turvy world where things are not what they should be and words don't seem to mean what they should mean. You can't make someone into a priest, even if he's a Levite. The fact that now you have a Levite as your priest doesn't mean God favors you. Furthermore, as I forgot who asked about the role of the Levites and the priests and what are they doing. Instead of the Levite instructing Micha and telling him, you know, you really shouldn't worship God through image. You should destroy the image and worship God properly. No, instead the Levite accepts the arrangement because it offers him comfort and security and a livelihood that he's happy with, accepts his place in this home of God, quote unquote, and in Micha's family home, and becomes the priest and the spiritual father of the household. And this is somehow supposed to be Geula. This is somehow supposed to be restoring things, making things better, making things good. Now, before I put it down too much, and I think I'm it's not just me judging it from my, you know, one might say I'm judging it from a narrow Orthodox modern point of view, but the story judges it largely because the story will show us how shaky the foundations of this home are once pressure is applied to them, to it. But before I go into that, I do want to point out that there's a few optimistic hints hidden within this parody and piety that Micah is enacting in his household. The first is that the mother forgives him. If a mother can forgive her son who wronged her, maybe God can forgive us, his people, who wronged him. So much of the book of Judges is us betraying God, us the Israelites betraying God. When we see a mother blessing her child who wronged her, it's almost like a red light flashing and telling us there's hope yet, there's hope yet, there's hope yet. In fact, we don't even need to say it's hope, it's reality. We know that time and time again, even though the people betrayed God, he sent a savior to them when they suffered. He blessed them so to speak, instead of cursing them. So there's a certain sense here that underneath the mistakes, underneath the twists and the rottenness of society, there's a God waiting for us to reach out to him, and he will reach out to us back. He will accept us back. But the second optimistic hint has to do with the good intentions. Because while the way Micha goes about in serving God is all wrong, the fact that he wants to serve God, the fact that he wants to improve the house of God by bringing a Levite and not just one of his sons as a priest, the fact that he wants to restore his relationship with his mother, even if there's some self-interest in the motivation there, all of this means that he's not a bad person. He's a person of good intentions. He's doing what's right in his own eyes, and he doesn't know better, it seems, but he has good intentions. So when we see good intentions on the one hand, and a God, a hint at a God who is willing to forgive us, we can be forgiven for thinking that maybe these two things together will amount to geula, to restoration, to our restored relationship with God. In a sense, if this was a natural story, meaning not a story that's trying to teach us a message, but rather the way things are in the world, a reflection of reality, many times in reality, the way things work are, you know, there's good intentions on both sides. And then even though people go about it wrong, slowly and gradually through natural evolution almost, things get better. But the message of the book of Judges, as we will see momentarily, is that that doesn't actually work because that doesn't fix anything. For the relationship between us and God to be restored truly, it cannot be built on the faulty foundation of idol worshiping. It cannot. A home that is built on shaky foundation has to fall before the good things in it, the good intentions and God's good intentions, can be used to create something better. And this, in a sense, is the logic behind the entire section of Judges we're studying this week and next week, the section where everything falls apart. Because before something better can be reborn, the bad foundations need to be shown for what they are, and cleared free to make room, which in itself is an optimistic message because it means that as we watch things deteriorate, we're also watching the road being cleared for the rise of something better in the book of Samuel. Let's leave it that now, because first, before we can get to the optimistic bits, alas, we have to see how this house falls, and fall it does. But before it can fall, we need to be introduced to a new set of characters and a new story, which very much like Micha's story, starts from people trying to restore a mistake, from people trying to make things better. Except that this time the people who are trying to make something better are not individuals per se, but rather a whole tribe of Israel. And what they're trying to fix is not, you know, stealing money from their mother, but it is two of the oldest sins that cast their shadow over the Israelite story. Let's see it in the text. I'm moving on to box three. It's Judges 18, which introduces the Danites, Shevet Dan. In those days, there was no king in Israel, in case we forgot it from last chapter. And in those days, the tribe of Dan was seeking a territory in which to settle. For to that day, no territory had fallen to their lot among the tribe of Israel. Now, just to clarify, it doesn't mean that they didn't get a piece of land designated to them. It's just that their piece of land, which is to the west of Benjamin and Judah's land, between basically in the flatlands right next to the Mediterranean Sea, those lands were overrun by Philistines. And the Danites were pressured by the Philistines on the one side, butting already into the territory of other tribes to their east, and they just didn't have where to live. They couldn't really live there. We met Shimshon from Shevet Dan, who lives in that area, in the area of Tzora and Eshtaol, that's in the hill country between the Judean mountains and the sea. And we see how closely entangled he is with the Philistines. This is the reality that Shevet Dan is trying to escape. And here's what they do to escape it. In verse 2, the Danites sent out 5 of their number from their clan seat at Sorai Meshtaol, valiant men, to spy out the land and explore it. Go, they told them, and explore the land. When they advanced into the hill country of Ephraim, as far as the house of Michal, they stopped there for the night. Before we continue, I want to explain which two mistakes, which two old sins, this action of the Danites seems to correct or to promise to correct. The promise, of course, is going to disappoint us later, this being the book of Judges, but we'll get to that. One is a sin that predates our time in Israel, the sin of the spies. When we were first meant to go as a nation into the land of Israel, we sent spies, much like the Dan, Shevet Dan here does. The spies came back and told the people, the land is beautiful, its fruits are great, and we shouldn't go there because we will be overrun by enemies. And instead of standing firm and saying, if God could take us out of Egypt, God can win these wars for us, the people, forgive the jargon, forgive the slang, freak out, cry through the night, decide they don't want to go to the land of Israel, feel that Moshe and God brought them out of the desert just to bring them to their death, and in doing so, lose their opportunity to go into Israel. Because God said, you know what? You prefer to die in the desert? Die in the desert. Your children will go in. You will not go in. When Shevet Dan sends spies to find the land for themselves, and with that we see implied that they're serious about conquering the land, serious about finding a place to root themselves in, it's almost as if they're repeating the action that Moshe made when he sent the spies, but with a better spirit, with a collective spirit of devotion. We will see later, I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler alert, that when the spies come back and tell the Dan and Shevet Dan about the land they found, they use wording, the wording they use to encourage the people to go and conquer the land is reminiscent of what Caleb and Joshua, the only two spies to be in a dissenting opinion during the sin of the spies in the desert, used to encourage the people. Caleb and Joshua fail. These spies succeed and the whole tribe rises to go and find a place to live in the land of Israel. So that already looks like a promise of redemption, a promise of restoring, fixing an old sin. The other sin that casts shadow throughout the book of Judges is the original cause of all the people suffering in this book, namely the fact that in the very first chapter, they failed to fully conquer the land. They got up, they asked God, who shall rise first for us? He said, Judah. And then Judah went and fought their war, and Benjamin went and fought that war, and Dan went and fought their war. Everybody fought their separate wars, and everybody, without exception, only succeeded at conquering part of the land allotted to them. Some more, like Judah or Ephraim, and some significantly less, like Shevet Dan. So in a sense, that was the sin that got God so angry that he said, from now on, I wouldn't let you fully vanquish the people, and they will live amongst you as a temptation and a lure, constantly testing your resolve to keep to the covenant and not worship their gods. And the cycle of, just a moment, the whole tragic cycle of Shoftim starts because the people keep falling for that lure. Yes.
In Sefer Yoshua, there is a big collection of prakim, I think until Yud or Yud Aleph, that shows a lot of miracles that Hashem does in the times of Yoshua. And it seems to be from that, that really all the land was conquered. So what happened between that stage to Shoftim? What's just really happened?
I'm sorry
to interrupt.
No, it's okay. It's a good question. I'm not an expert on Yoshua. I'm not going to presume to be, but I will say what I learned, which is that in Yoshua, it doesn't outline in those chapters you mentioned what they didn't conquer, but it does mention it towards the end of the book that there's still land to conquer. And Yoshua sends the people back home and says, now go and complete the work. And it becomes clear already at the end of Yoshua and more clear at the beginning of Shoftim that Yoshua led the people in the big wars that established their dominance in the promised land. But, and then divided the lands by lot so that every tribe knows where they're supposed to settle. And then Yoshua sends them home saying, now you go and complete it. I got, you know, dominance over the general area and specific places here. You have to go and complete it. And they don't. Now you could say it's not, you know, a sin to lose a war, right? You're not a sinful person if you lost the war. On a deeper level, the failure in the beginning of Judges is that they don't unite. That each tribe other than Judah and Shimon who work together conquers on their own. And on their own, they just can't do it. And the mistake that haunts us to this day is that we don't unite, that we don't know how to work together as a people, that it's hard for us to do that. We will discuss more the question of unity and disunity next week when we reach the story of the concubine in Givah. I see that some people raise their hands and I'll try and get back to you in a bit, but we need to proceed now. So I'll try and get back to you with questions. I'll try to leave time for it at the end. For now, let us just say that Shevet Dan failed at conquering most of their land. And then they seem to be ready and willing to fix that. They're saying, we're ready to find a land where we can win. We can't win here. We can't win against the Philistines who have a monopoly on iron at this point, who have chariots, who have weaponry that outperforms what the Israelites has quite significantly. We can't, but we will find a piece of land that we can conquer and do what we were supposed to do from the get-go. Except that just like Micha's attempts to do the right thing, everything they do is based on wrong assumptions. Because it's based on the assumption, first and foremost, that they can just choose any piece of land and that'll be okay. But that's not okay. God allotted specific pieces of land to specific tribes. God didn't do it arbitrarily. There's been a lot of work done, and we don't have time to get into it, but I would recommend the book Tribal Lands. It's a beautiful analysis of how the land of each tribe corresponds to some essential nature or essential traits in this tribe. God had intentions. The Danites think they're fixing the mistake of not doing what God told them, but they're doing it against God's will and against his instructions, much as Micha is worshiping God against God's will, against God's explicit instructions in the Torah. This irreverent reverence, almost, or disparity and piety, comes to sharp relief when the five spies of Dan visit Micha's house. At first, it looks like a beautiful moment of hospitality. Here is Micha from Shevet Ephraim, and he opens his house to these people from a different tribe. This is a rare event in Shoftim, that people offer hospitality of this kind to one another across tribal land. But then see what happens after they fall asleep there. I'm in verse 3. While in the vicinity of Micha's house, they recognized the speech of the young Levite. So they went over and asked him, who brought you to these parts? What are you doing in this place? What is your business here? He replied, thus and thus Micha did for me. He hired me and I became his priest. They said to him, please inquire of God. We would like to know if the mission on which we are going will be successful. In and of itself, this desire to have God's guidance, right, is a beautiful thing. Here are people living their life and they clearly think of God as someone who should have a say, right? Except they don't ask, should we go on this road? Is this the right thing to do? They just ask, will we be successful? Which is a very different question. And the Levite doesn't ask God. He just gives his own answer. He says, "Go in peace," the priest said to them. The Lord views with favor the mission you are going on. It's play acting. It's play acting in reverence, play acting piety. They go. They found a nation that lives far to the north, in what is today Golan Heights, a place that is lives in peace because they're not part of the promised land per se, and no, they're not afraid of the Israelite tribes. And they run home and tell their people, "Come, rise, let's go." They say, it's very beautiful in verse 9 here, "Kuma v'na'ale," let us rise and rise up, get up and rise up. We saw the land and it is very good. They're echoing what Yoshua and Kalev told the people trying to stop them from not going into Israel. They're encouraging them with this rhetoric of faith and excitement. And what do, though? They gather themselves. They arm themselves. The whole tribe in mass travels. And when they pass by Micha's house, the men who hosted them, who showed them kindness, what do they say? They say, "Oh, wait, he has this nice temple with all these nice, you know, religious objects and this nice image, graven image and the Pesach. Let's take it with us. That would be great. We can bring these things with us and have a temple when we get to our new land." Because of course that's the right thing to do, right? Of course the right thing to do is to rob somebody else's things while you're, after he showed you hospitality. Now I'm going to jump a little bit ahead. I'm in the middle of box 5, verse 15, where this story of betraying someone's kindness is compounded when the Levite man joins the betrayal. So they turned off there near Micha's house and entered the home of the young Levite at Micha's house and greeted him. The 600 Danite men, geared with their weapons of war, stood at the entrance of the gate, while the 5 men who had gone to spy out the land went inside and took the sculptured image, the ephod, the teraphim, and the molten image. The priest was standing at the entrance of the gate, and the 600 men gripped with their weapons of war, while those men entered Micha's house and, wait a minute, I just read that. Sorry. The priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And we might hope that he will stand up for his benefactor, right? The man who is now like his father and son in some ways. No. But they said to him, "Be quiet. Put your hand on your mouth. Come with us and be our father and priest. Would you rather be priest to one man's household or be priest to a tribe and clan in Israel?" The priest was delighted. He took the ephod, the household gods, and the sculptured image, and he joined the people. They set out again, placing the children, the cattle, and their household goods in front. The fact they're putting their children, their cattle, and their household goods in front means that they're expecting to be attacked not from the front, where the enemy they're about to face is, but from the back. Because they know they just robbed someone, they know that he might give chase, and they're ready for it. And then when he gives chase, they give a totally amazing answer. Amazing in the sense that it's just so honest. It's so brutally honest. Micha runs after them. And before he even says anything, in verse 23, they respond in indignation. They, that is Micha and his people, called out to the Danites, who turned around and said to Micha, "What's the matter? Why have you mustered? Don't you know why you mustered?" He said, "You have taken my priests and the gods that I made and walked off. What do I have left? How can you ask what's the matter?" What kind of chutzpah is this, right? But the Danites replied, "Don't do any shouting at us, or some desperate man might attack you, and you and your family would lose your lives." This is such an ominous sentence. Here they are, 600 armed men. And they're unashamed. They just tell him, "You don't want to do this. You don't want to start fighting with us, arguing with us. Some bitter, desperate man, not us, but some desperate man might raise their hands to you. You want to be careful." So Micha, realizing that they were stronger than he, turned back and went home, and the Danites went on their way. Just like that, might makes right. The irony that underlies everything we read so far, of course, is that these gods are meaningless. The sculpture, the ephod, the teraphim, we know, reading it, that it's all meaningless. He calls it my God that I made, and they attribute value to it enough to want to steal it and take it for themselves. But it's meaningless. It's not something that actually brings joy to God. It's not actually something that honors God. It's not something God wants from us. And in a weird way, what the Danites do is almost a echo of what Micha does on a larger scale. He stole from his mother. They steal from him. He thought he can serve God in this weird, twisted way. They think they can serve God in an even more twisted way, not only with idols, but with stolen idols. Two commandments, right? If we take the Lo Tignov as pshat and not the way Rashi takes it as murder. They think that that's somehow pleasing to God. It's completely ignoring what gives objects power and assuming that the objects have power in and of themselves. Instead of doing what God actually wants from us, they think that they can force upon God a form of worship that's forged through impiety, through theft, through injustice. And they carry it with them as they go and fall upon this unsuspecting people up north, massacre them, conquer the land that was not supposed to be their land, establish themselves as a rooted tribe there. And the whole terrible story ends by telling us that they did what they promised. Once they were there, they put the ephod and the teraphim and this Levite turned priest into a temple. And this temple was of such duration that it became an alternative center of worship in Israel for the duration of the existence of Shiloh. I'm here in the same box, box six at the bottom. They maintained the sculptured image that Micha had made throughout the time that the house of God stood at Shiloh. So instead of everybody going to the correct home of God, Beit Elokim in Shiloh, and worshiping God as he wants, and not Isha Yashar Ben Avyaseh, every person has read in his own eyes, as Moshe warned us in Dvarim, we have this temple that's built on a foundation of theft, of idolatry, of murder, murdering this unsuspecting city of Gentiles that we had no reason to attack and no godly mandate to go into war with. And somehow that's supposed to be piety. That's supposed to be a good thing. This has to come tumbling down. What's built on wrongs, what's built on injustice, what's built on betrayals cannot support the national home of the Jewish people, cannot become a family, cannot restore the Jewish family and build a nation. But how will it fall? Who will do the job of eradicating what's wrong and building what's right? The text here seems to hint very heavily that he who should do that is a king. Because not only do we keep hearing that every person did what was right and straight in their own eyes, we also hear, in those days there was no king in Israel. Now, when you hear it often enough within a story that shows how society does everything wrong and how strong people can take whatever they want from weaker people because there's no one to stop them. We can read the signs, right? We can read the map. We can see where it's pointing. We can say, oh, I guess we need a king. Except that it doesn't actually make any sense if you think about it for 2 seconds, because as we will find out in the book of Kings, kings often lead the people into idolatry. Kids often abuse their power. Think of Achav taking Naboth, the Israelites' vineyard, and killing him through judicial murder, basically. Well, not him. His wife managed it all for him. Kings abuse their power all the time, much like the Danites do here. Kings build idolatrous alternative centers, much like Yerovam ben Nevat does in Sefer Melachim. The truth is, we don't even need to go that far. We don't need to go two books ahead into the book of Kings to see that giving people power to win, to power over other people, is not necessarily the best way to heal society. We already know that. We know that from Abimelech. We saw Abimelech, who made himself king after killing his brothers, and how he ended up massacring the city of Shechem. This is the one instance of kingship we actually saw in the book of Judges. And is that supposed to somehow be a solution for the problems of the era? Is that somehow supposed to restore, remove the faulty foundation, build the right foundation, make sure that people have guidance, that the fabric of society is healed to the point that when someone shows kindness to another, they repay him in kind and don't, you know, betray him and steal what's dear to him? That doesn't add up, right? And that is indeed the big paradox, I think, of the book of Judges. That it shows us the problems with entrusting power to fallible men. It shows us the problems in a society that a leader cannot fix on his or her own. It's problems that go far deeper into the society. And then the only solution it overtly and explicitly promotes is monarchy. And the question rises, why? Next week, we will revisit this question and offer a deeper answer that really encompasses the process we went through in learning the whole book. Today, I want to offer a temporary answer. It's also true. It's also a good answer, but I don't think it addresses everything Judges has to say about the topic. It's just a little taste. And in this answer, I'm following the scholarship of Professor Eli Aziz and his wonderful book in the Magid series about Shoftim, a book in Hebrew. I highly recommend it to anyone who's able and interested in reading it.
Eli what? What's Eli's name?
Eli Aziz. I'll write it in the chat. So Eli Aziz says that the book of Judges does not promote monarchy as something that's good in and of itself. Rather, it points out that kingship is better than anarchy. When the choices are between a society that falls apart in a terrible way and people hurt each other, as we will see more next week. In this week, the violence is implied. It's threatened, but it's avoided overall because Micha doesn't pursue them. Next week, violence will in fact erupt on a national scale. So when this is the alternative, we may as well have a king, because at least the king will be good for one thing, and that is limiting local problems from blowing out of proportion and involving more and more and more and more people in the struggle. Just a second. Shira, can you post that in the chat, the source sheet again, please? Thank you. Just 1 minute. In our story, we have a local problem, a family problem between father and son, mother and son, that then becomes a tribal problem when one tribe steals the products of the restored argument between father and mother and son, and then becomes a national obstacle because this center of worship draws people from beyond Shevet Dan itself. And this is something that a king might avert. A king might help deal with problems when they're still on the local level and stop them from spreading. And the need for that, for someone who can put a heavy hand down and stop things from escalating, will become very clear next week when we read the horrible, horrible, terrible story of the concubine and Giva. Now, this is the end of my prepared lesson for whoever needs to leave now, and thank you for being here. I will take 2 minutes to answer some of the questions from the chat. I can't answer all of them, as always, but I'll answer some. Batya pointed out that the mother and son conversation, where he recalls that she made an imprecation against whoever stole her money, reminds me, but you're right, of Jacob saying that whoever took the idols would die, and Rachel dies. So And there too, Jacob doesn't know that Rachel is going to be the one to suffer from his imprecation. And of course, there it's idols, here it's money, but it's money that's going to be to idols. So I think it's a really beautiful comparison. Thank you, Batya, for pointing it out. Just a minute. Shelly Shapiro wrote, pagan gods are all about power. Shelly, are you still here? Would you like to elaborate on what you mean by this? Shelly? Okay, Shelly's not here, I think, but I will say something to it. It's true. And I think one of the big messages, I'm teaching Shmot in a different place, and specifically right now about Mount Sinai. And one of the big messages in God's revelation in Shmot in general and in Sinai, it's made explicit, is that God is not about bringing the people to their knees. The kind of worship God wants is not us, you know, just subjugating ourselves to him. God demands from us to respect each other. What God wants from us is to see Tzelem Elohim in other people. In other words, to truly accept God's messages as expressed in the Exodus and in Mount Sinai, and I can't go into it in detail now, but to truly accept God's messages is to live a life of justice, to avoid exploitation, to help the weak because we were slaves in the land of Egypt, as God repeatedly tells us when he gives us these sorts of commandments. So it's not about power. It's about accepting a certain principle of justice, a certain principle of responsibility. But when you turn the worship of God into an idol worship, into something that you create with your money, and you invest people as priests, it's about your power over the spiritual message, or somebody else's power if they're stronger than you, as Michal learns when the Danites take those guts from him. Okay, so for now I have to finish. If anybody has an urgent question, you can write to Shira in Torah in Motion and ask for my email, and I authorize her to give it to you. And on this note, thank you so much, everybody, and I'm looking forward to meeting you next week for the grand finale, to tie all the threads together and see how it all comes crashing down and opening a door for redemption in the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
Have a nice week.
Very good.
Thank you.